Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Barling and Barrett on Crime. Manny, what delights do we have in store for our listeners today?
Well, today's news, of course, is that Casey Anthony sought a brain transplant, but the doctors discovered she didn't have one. So that's a
show. Okay. All right. You're officially off the list as being, chief joke writer.
No, but that's what we're going to explore. Because basically the things that are going on with Casey Anthony are things that go along with a brainless party who just does things in life and doesn't understand what she's doing, doesn't accept the consequences of her acts, and basically leaves everybody to ponder and wonder, what the heck is she doing? So we really are going to get into a little bit of all these Casey Anthony lawsuits, because believe me, Casey Anthony did not even consider that all this stuff would generate litigation. She had no clue what she was starting. She pushed a terribly large boulder off the cliff with the story she told. That boulder has gained size and spreading like wildfire, and we're going to discuss some of the lawsuits as part of the boulder. But first, we got to tell you the funny story of the week. It's a story about a very happy meal for some lonely guy if he took it. Police arrested a woman outside of McDonald's in Burbank, California, after she allegedly offered sex to a customer in exchange for his chicken McNuggets. She allegedly opened car doors near the drive-in window to offer her services. According to the article, the men allegedly turned down her proposition, but who knows how many men didn't turn her down before she was caught. So it's a wild story, isn't it?
Oh, I love it. You know, the idea of trading sex for chicken nuggets, it sounds outrageous, but not so. I was involved in a real life example. It was several years ago. I was operating or running a computer learning center out of a homeless shelter, and one Saturday I turned up just to say hi, and I spotted a guy that I knew. We'll call him Gary. Well, that was his name. And Gary was homeless because he had a gambling problem. You know, he'd get paid on Friday and broke on Saturday. He just loved the casino. Anyway, this particular Saturday morning, he was grumpy because he'd been to the casino and had no money. So I said, "Okay, Gary, so what you gonna do?" And he said, "Well, I'm going to get me a six-pack and a hoe." And I said, that's pretty tough to do with no money. And anyway, it was about 8 a.m., 9 a.m. He said, we can fix this. You want to come along? I had nothing better to do, so I followed him. And he took me down some of the finest side streets I'd ever seen.
I can imagine.
Right, and he spotted a large dumpster, and he said, "This is it. Gold in there." I'm going, okay. He jumps into the dumpster and comes out. He's just yelling with glee. He found a bag of cans. He said, "Couple more of these, we're all set." And great. Okay, so, I'm tagging along, and sure enough, he dives into a couple more dumpsters. He ends up with more bags than he can carry, so he does the obvious thing. Just borrow a supermarket cart that had been conveniently left, and we headed off to the bottle depot you know, to reclaim the 10 cents per beer can. Got the money?
Yeah.
And I said, okay, Gary, what do we do next? He said, liquor store. And off we went. We bought a six, or he bought a six pack of really, really cheap beer, although nothing was cheap in this particular town. And I calculated that he probably had about $5 left. And I said, oh, what's next? He said, Simon, I'm going to treat you. I'm going to buy you lunch. I went, oh, this should be interesting. Yeah, because $5 doesn't go a long way in the average restaurant. Nah, Gary took me to another homeless shelter, and we had a pretty unmemorable lunch, but yeah, he was good for his word. He bought me lunch, and I said, all right, Gary, you've got your six-pack. You bought me lunch. Where's the hoe? And he said, hang on. And he looks around the room, motions to this incredibly ugly-looking woman. She comes over, and he says, okay, tell you what. I'll share my six-pack for sex. And she thought about it for about half a nanosecond and said, okay.
I love it.
I at that point, I laughed.
Well, you know, this happens across the board. So, you know, my wife, Ash, as you know, cut up this article out of the newspaper for me to use on today's show. So later that night when the lights were turned off and, you know, we did what all married couples are supposed to do, right? So when we're done, my wife slipped over and whispered in my ear, so, honey, where's my chicken McNuggets? I almost fell out of the bed laughing. I couldn't stop laughing at it. Her timing and delivery was perfect. So tonight, all you men out there, if your wife wants chicken McNuggets, rush to the store. Maybe it may help you more than seeing a counselor will. So we're going to shift the subject before I get in deeper trouble. I mean, we've got to touch on Michael Jackson for a moment. You know, you probably saw the article, and I know we discussed a little bit how the L.A. prosecutors decided not to seek restitution from Conrad Murray after they talked to the singer's parents, attorneys, Michael's children, and a few other people just before the court hearing. Well, guess what? The prosecutor was claiming that he lost $100 million and they should assess Conrad Murray for the $100 million loss for this so-called This Is It concert. But what got me and you is that they also wanted Conrad Murray to pay for Jackson's funeral expenses, which were $1.8 million. I mean, you know, now murderers across America, before they shoot somebody, they have to ask themselves, am I going to have to pay for his funeral too?
Well, you know, I'm bombarded on the by the TV ads for you need this life insurance policy. It's $10 a month, and you know, there's no medical, no nothing, you know, and that this can fix your final expenses. And I'm beginning to wonder if it's not such a bad idea. I mean, you know, 1.8 million. I mean, that's a schwack of cash for any family to come up with.
Well, yeah, well, you know, not only a schwack of cash, but, I mean, are we now financing funerals too? I mean, here's a guy who's going to prison, has no money to even pay his lawyers, and the prosecutors are wasting everybody's time and money by trying to get him to pay back basically $102 million. You know, sure, he can do that working part-time making license plates in California prison, you know. That's about the extent of it. What do they expect?
Well,
and, you know, and that, go ahead.
Haven't they also yanked his medical license? So, you know, when he gets out in 2 years or less than 2 years, he really doesn't have much of a career to go back to.
Sure, it's car wash, security guard, or box boy. I mean, there aren't a lot of choices. You know, and worse than that, when I was looking at the lawsuit after you and I discussed it, it turns out that Michael Jackson's father, Joe, filed a wrongful death case against Conrad Murray and basically alleging that he should be paid wrongful death damages and some huge amount of money because of Michael's death. Well, first of all, anyone who knows the family knows that Joe and Michael were not in the same room very often. They didn't get along. Michael had cut him off years and years ago. He also disinherited him. So here's Joe Jackson trying to get money that he would have lost because of the death of his beloved son, who didn't like him and basically disowned him and cut him out of the will. And worse than that, Brian Oxman filed the lawsuit, which was really unbelievable to me, knowing that Brian Oxman's about to get disbarred. So, you know, when I look at that, I go, why is Brian Oxman doing that? Why is Joe Jackson doing it when the state bar is accusing him of mixing clients' personal funds, evading creditors and sanctions imposed upon him? And I know it's true because I was a witness at his last state bar prosecution and helped him get off once, even though it was kind of stuck in my throat to do it, but it was the truth. He didn't deserve it, but I know he's evading the creditors and sanctions because I know at least one case where he got whacked with a whole bunch of money because of something he did. So Michael Jackson's father hires his longtime attorney knowing, of course, to hire him, Brian always worked for nothing, so I don't think that Joe Jackson's paying him for this either. So what we have is a classic case of people looking for publicity and just playing upon this whole thing. Michael Jackson's death has become a cottage industry for people, and that's sad.
Well, this brings up the whole issue of civil litigation. I mean, you can't get blood out of a stone. You know, so why even bother going against Conrad Murray?
Well, as I say all the time, the reason for these lawsuits are lawyers looking for publicity and individuals looking for publicity. Even in O.J. Simpson's case, I thought Nicole Brown Simpson's sister used it to capitalize on getting herself out there. You know, here she was doing all this moaning over the loss of her sister, who was not a very nice person if she was a saint. And when I watched what she did over a period of time, it was hard to separate the self-indulgence from the mourning. And a lot of people usually mourn. They go off in a corner, and they spend a year or two trying to get over the loss of a loved one. And every time they don't do that, and they go out in public, unless it's something like, America's, the guy does America's 10 Most Wanted, who lost his son, who was kidnapped,
right.
or Amber, or one of these other ones, where there's really socially important impact to it. Most of them are just looking for publicity, and I don't know why.
But O.J. was a slightly different situation. He did have money, and I've talked to the Goldman's attorney. His name escapes me right now.
Patrick Kelly?
No.
Or the collection lawyer?
Right.
Yeah, I don't remember his name.
Yeah, and I mean, there was sort of a point to it, but, you know, going after the likes of Conrad Murray, you know, there's no pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
Well, yeah. O.J. is going to segue into Casey Anthony in one respect. Casey Anthony is a resident of Florida. But O.J., like so many of the people I've seen, and recently had an episode of it, people move to Florida, particularly corporate CEOs, when they think they're going to be held for libel for something or they need to file bankruptcy, because Florida has the most liberal laws in the country. And you can keep $1 million home and not have it go in bankruptcy as a personal exclusion and in Florida. So O.J. moved to Florida where his assets were better protected. That's why he didn't move there to play golf. And at the end, it made it even harder for them to get money. They got a $33 million judgment against O.J. Simpson that made me fall over laughing. First of all, what was she – I mean, if you want to talk about the way insurance companies do and wrongful deaths and projecting what a life is worth or whatever, absolutely no one who ever met Nicole Simpson would have ever said her life was worth $33 million. You know, if you want to talk in legal terms like lawyers who do personal injury and wrongful death cases – it's an unbelievable, unexplainable number. And more importantly, I don't think they've collected more than a few a few hundred thousand dollars. And yes, it's better than nothing. And yet, on the other side of the family, the Brown family worried about their grandchildren. That money is taken away from Simpson's grandchildren because it wasn't going to go to him anyway. So there's a mixed feeling about it. So even though Simpson's in jail, his residence is still Florida, and he is still collecting his NFL retirement amount of money, which is about probably $220,000 a year, maybe a little bit more. So here he is. Let's say he serves 5 years in jail. He'll earn over $1 million in jail, and that money, because it comes from a pension fund, cannot be attacked, nor can it be attached. So what good does all this do?
Right. But, you know, O.J. has assets. Let's talk about someone that doesn't have any assets. Let's, you know, for the sake of argument, let's call her Casey Anthony.
Well, that's a good choice. Well, you know, Casey already lives in Florida, so she doesn't have to move to Florida. She's already there. So I want to preface this conversation about the lawsuits with this comment. She probably has a 3-year wait. You need 3 calendar years to give the IRS an opportunity to collect. After the 3 years, so if she were assessed for that income tax in 2010, it was a 2009 year, I believe, her tax return was due in 2015. She doesn't pay this money. So it's 3 years. So April 15th, approximately, give or take a few nuances, she's eligible to file bankruptcy and wipe out her IRS debt. Well, I don't think she's going to acquire enough assets between now and 2013 to worry about losing them in a bankruptcy. So almost every lawsuit and the IRS would just go by filing bankruptcy.
Well, okay. You're the lawyer. I'm just the regular Joe on the street. I thought that you could not get rid of the IRS by filing bankruptcy.
No, not true. The bankruptcy code now allows the IRS to try to collect for 3 years. So let's say you owe the IRS $1 million for last year. If you file bankruptcy, it won't go away. But if you wait 3 years from the date that money became due, when you filed your return, you would be eligible to wipe it out in bankruptcy. So, yes, that's a common way to do it. And I see it happen, and I've done it quite frequently for wives whose husbands were flakes and got into a divorce, and the wives suddenly found their husbands hadn't paid income taxes for 4 years. They never saw a dime of it. In one case, I had a client whose husband had been filing his returns but hadn't paid the taxes for 6 years, and he was on some kind of ridiculous payment plan. He shouldn't even know about it. When they got a divorce, the IRS wanted to collect from her, but it had been so far back, some of it, that she filed bankruptcy. And what happened was they didn't consider the current years. So a number of years later, the IRS started trying to collect from her for the 3 years before she filed bankruptcy, and she had to file bankruptcy again to get rid of those 3 years. And that's what happens commonly, and it's more commonly occurs among women whose husbands lie about their tax problems to them. Is that a shock that husbands lie to women? Lie to their wives if they're in debt with the IRS? Oh, honey, everything's just fine. You know, I don't think the average guy wants to sit at the dinner table and say to his wife, oh, by the way, honey, I didn't pay our income taxes last year. I wasted it on my mistress, so I really can't pay them, and we're in trouble. Oh, wow. I think every guy who's that kind of has that level of dishonesty is going to lie to his wife every single time, don't you?
Yes, but talking about this particular situation, am I correct in thinking that Casey might not be the only person liable with the IRS?
Well, that will depend. She was paid by a network. It was NBC, right, that paid her? Do you remember which one?
I think
one?
It was ABC.
Was it ABC? Well, ABC may have had a duty to withdraw money from those funds and pay them to the IRS. You know, what happens now is you have to give, even if you, let's say you make a deal with a newspaper, which I did recently in the National Enquirer over Casey Anthony, and they want the basic tax information of the client that I represented, and they report it to the IRS. Well, there's two ways. One is salary, and the other one is called a 1099. If they send a 1099, then ABC is not liable for any taxes. If they used a W-2 and a W-4, then they are probably liable for not withdrawing it. So the question becomes whether or not they were required by law to withdraw that money. Well, you know, if you win money on a game show, you have to pay taxes on it, and they deduct those taxes from the value of the furniture or whatever it is that you win. And one of the things, by the way, that happens to game show contestants is they always show, you've just won $10,000 worth of furniture, but you look at the furniture and go, you know, I could buy that in the corner for $1,500. So then they try and tax you on the actual value, the declared value of the furniture instead of what it's really worth. And I've had friends and clients who sold the furniture to prove to the IRS that that's all it was worth is what they could sell it for. So sometimes you see these people win, you know, a huge amount of money and toys like a vacation on Wheel of Fortune. They're going to pay income tax on that trip to the Caribbean. And a lot of people don't realize that.
Wow.
So, and conceivably, every benefit that Casey Anthony has received, including these gifts from these post-trial friends who supposedly, you know, paid for her to go to the Caribbean when she's not allowed to leave the state, whoever's paying for her room and board, et cetera, now, that's income to her, and she should have to pay income taxes on it. So, you know, there are a lot of issues. If the IRS wants to pursue her, they can pursue her. But
the bigger question is, will the IRS want to pursue?
Well, that's the issue. There's a general rule among IRS agents, and I had to four IRS agents in my law school class went back to the IRS and hold administrative positions now. And they used to tell us that if there isn't $50,000 to get out of the case, they're not interested. So if they feel that they can't get the other money from her within 3 years, then she's likely to file bankruptcy. They lose the taste for doing it. They're interested in chasing people with a lot of money or have a huge amount of equity in their home, and they can't escape the IRS debt. And so that's become a factor. So, and one of the problems in our society, by the way, is you hear all the time, if we collected all the money owed to the IRS, we would not have a national debt. Well, when you look at those numbers, probably 80% of it are oppressive penalties and oppressive interest and oppressive charges. So the reality is that income tax, that they brag about, the huge amount of money, is probably worth 20 cents on the dollar. And then before they get to a point where they can't collect it, as you know, they're now compromising. I mean, there are all these people run ads. Come to us and we'll negotiate your IRS deal away. So, you know, at the end of the day, it's probably only worth 20 cents on the dollar, so they settle it for 20 cents on the dollar, and they end up paying what they actually owed in the first place without all the oppressive penalties and interest. I mean, our country is so convoluted at times.
So, basically, what I'm getting from you is Casey can just ignore the IRS.
Oh, yeah, most people do. So what happens is the average person in this country who files income tax returns based on their salary are terrified of the IRS because they hear all these stories. The average businessman who's deals with the IRS constantly, doesn't file his income tax returns till October 15th instead of April 15th, buries them among all the corporate returns, which are due in September 15th, so that instead of looking like a big wage earner, they look like small potatoes next to IBM, Xerox, Berkshire Hathaway, and all these other companies. So they plan and schedule and do everything they can to slow the IRS down, because the IRS uses basically computer matching programs. So you're better off matched up with a corporation than you are blue-collar workers in America filing April 15th. So people either are law-abiding citizens or they're people who look for ways to cheat the IRS because they see them as their dark enemy. And anyone who earns more than $100,000 a year sees them as a dark energy, and those corporate executives earning $500,000, $1 million, or, people like Romney who don't want to release their tax returns, are guys who spend a huge amount of money every year planning their life around how to reduce their IRS taxation. And really, that's Romney's problems with his tax returns. It isn't the amounts. It's the scheming and manipulating to reduce them that can be unattractive. And listen, I advise clients on how to do it. I mean, it's lawyers, corporate lawyers, and successful lawyers spend as much time advising clients how to deal with the IRS as they do anything else.
Oh, indeed. Let's get back to Casey and her civil suits for a moment.
Oh, good. Can we start with Texas EquiSearch? I love that case.
Oh, yes. All right.
Why don't you explain to us who Texas EquiSearch is and what they do?
They're essentially a donation-driven organization run by a gentleman by the name of Tim Miller. And, when little people or even big people go missing, they will jump in and help out. Tim Miller and Texas EquiSearch have a suit running that they want to recover the $100,000 that they claim they spent looking for what was clearly a fraudulent search. They were duped. Casey knew that the little girl was dead. You want to take it from there?
Well, yes, why not? Well, the word duped I find interesting because, basically speaking, Texas EquiSearch, if they wanted to sue her, should have walked into her with a contract as saying, okay, you want us to search for your child, you have to sign this contract. But they don't, because they start off saying that, oh, we're a charitable group, blah, blah, blah. Well, if you don't have a contractual right with somebody, it's very, very hard to sue them in this world. And that's where this lawsuit, to me, really gets interesting. How are they going to prove that Casey entered into some agreement with them to search for the child? Even if she was, manipulative, unethical, and we all agree she's all of those other things, assuming she told the truth, it was manipulative, unethical, but the question was, is it civilly illegal? It's certainly criminally wrong. But is there a civil right that allows anyone to recover? Well, we know there's restitution under the crime law. Forget Texas EquiSearch doesn't qualify for restitution under criminal law. So you ask yourself, Simon, what are the basis of them doing it? Because they volunteered. They're a good Samaritan. Now they're saying, whoa, we're a good Samaritan and you deceived us and you have to pay. Well, theoretically, I agree. I mean, I'm no fan of Casey Anthony's. I'd love to see her pay or do something. But the reality is, I keep asking myself, well, what basis does she pay on? Can you think of one?
No, I absolutely cannot. I see the problem as being one of differentiating between ethical behavior and, you know, dishonest behavior. Sure, I believe she, you know, didn't play a very fair game, but was it illegal? I kind of doubt it.
Well, yeah, that is the issue, is, you know, what law is designed to protect people from this kind of conduct? I mean, I don't know of anyone that does, and therein lies the problem. If you want to pass a law that say if you lie and deceive people in this world, you have to pay them damages, I would love it, because I think that's one of the backbones of the problems in our country, is the increase of lies and deceit among the general public, businessmen, and everyone else. It's just horrible. You know, it's sort of like there's a joke in America. If you see a corporate officer's lips moving, you know they're lying.
Yeah, I mean, I just can't see this case gaining any traction whatsoever. It's already bogged down. You know, Texas EquiSearch want to take Casey's deposition. And of course, Casey's people said, this is a fishing expedition. And the judge has gone along with it.
Well, he should. It is a fishing expedition.
Right. And the judge made an interesting ruling. Basically, she threw out most of the questions and only left two. And her reasoning, and I have to be absolutely honest here, I got this from a news agency, not the judge. She mentioned the word retrial. She was concerned that, you know, that some of the questions were potentially self-incriminating. Now, let me ask you about that. Isn't there something called double jeopardy?
Well, but the case isn't done yet. She's appealing, and she could be awarded a new trial, okay? So let's say that she is awarded a new trial. Well, then you start to have a slightly different issue. The issue, as you're pointing out, is, will anything she says in this deposition be used in that trial to in some manner convict her? And the answer is yes, it could be. So, yeah, that's a problem.
Well, okay. She'd be nuts to go for a retrial.
Well, then the issue's done.
Right.
They can ask those questions and approach them. I don't know why the court's even allowing that, to be very honest with you. Because the reality is that, you know, this lawsuit has really very little basis. And if they file what's called a demur, which in simple words means you're saying, so what? You file this lawsuit, but it has no legal basis. I would wonder why the court didn't dismiss it. So I have questions about why this case is still going on now.
Okay, this is probably where you and I differ. I can see reasons why it can be argued that Casey can't answer certain questions, not for criminal reasons, but rather civil ones, because what is said, you know, in one case could possibly spill over to another.
Well, that's true. Civil cases, though, it doesn't happen quite as much, because one of the things that happens in civil cases is you have to have a unity of facts and other things, and the question has to be asked for a particular case. So it may have interesting data, but it may not completely pertain to the next one. But no, it's criminal that they're worried about. If you make a mistake in a civil case, no judge is going to protect you. But if it's a criminal case and they start worrying about being reversed or being criticized by another judge, so she's being particularly cautious because she's worried about some type of criticism from somebody.
Okay. The ruling that the judge came down with, I think it was middle of last week, was that there were two questions that Casey was compelled to answer. The first one was the fact that Casey did not recall her father, George Anthony, making a 911 call. I mean, why on earth did they even ask it?
Got me. I thought about that after our conversation, and I keep going, I don't see the relevance to any of that. First of all, if you made the conversation, it would have been recorded, and it wouldn't even be something to discuss, right? I mean, there would be a record of it. So there is no record of it, so it obviously doesn't exist. So then, what does it matter? How does it impact the case? Can you figure that one out? I can't.
No. I've been banging my head against the wall on that one. I understand why you might be faced with pointless questions, but there's usually, a direction that they're trying to get to. And this direction doesn't head anywhere.
Yeah, well, I've had moments. I once did a deposition in a young lawyer there afterwards asked me, well, why didn't you ask that question? I looked at him with some sincerity and said, I really have no idea why. I said, it just sort of came out of me. And afterwards I said to myself, well, what does that mean? I mean, so there are moments when lawyers do that. You ask a question because it comes to your mind, and then afterwards you go, why did I do that? So, no, that's not uncommon at all. So,
okay, the second question, and in some ways it's far more interesting. Was she aware of Texas Equisearch conducting searches? And she replied, no.
Well, that shouldn't surprise you. We've talked about what her state of mind was, what she could remember, also her IQ level, et cetera. All the things that went on during there, she could have not even remembered speaking to him. That's not uncommon for parties and these type of events. Plus, when you read her published psychological profile, particularly the one written by the psychologist, what's it called, In the Mind of Casey Anthony, or whatever the title is of the book, and you look at her talking about supposed child abuse and all these other things and how it blocks minds and how it causes people to deal with things in certain ways. Well, she is somewhat of a textbook case of that. So conflict avoidance, all those psychological rules, I think apply to her. I mean, I don't think she really knows what she did during that period of time. That's the shame of it.
Yeah, but it was all over the news, you couldn't avoid it.
Well, I think you can. I see people, like, I've been so busy the last 3 weeks, I barely had time to, see the news. I walked out into the rain the other morning and didn't know it was going to rain in Los Angeles because I'd been so horribly busy, and I think that, when you read people publish things about people they don't want to hear or read, what do? They basically don't read the papers. So I bet she rarely read the newspapers during that period.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not trying to defend her. I'm just saying it's been my experiences that people just put their head in the sand and fall into the classic ostrich syndrome.
Okay, but at this point, Casey was at home with George and Cindy. Tim Miller was basically camping with them. And, you know, he was talking to her for many, many hours. In fact, one report says that he produced a map of the area, and he said, you know, Casey, we really want to find your missing child. Give us some ideas about where to look. Are you saying that she doesn't remember any of this?
No, I'm saying, first of all, who knows whether that really happened or not. Assuming all that happened, she really has no excuse. But I'm just saying to you that when you study, read books about these type people, they go into this regression all the time, and they just have trouble remembering where they were, what they did, and it's just the strangest thing I've ever seen. The human mind has a way of blocking things out that people don't want to deal with. And I think that watching her, and especially watching these recent pictures of her, the videos of her, they're causing so much conversation, she's quite capable of that. I mean, just dropping out into the ozone layer and just cutting off anything that has any memory involvement in her life. I mean, she has a quite a hiding coping mechanism. I mean, she just shuts the world off.
Okay, in legal terms, what is the chance of her being successful in this case?
Or Equisearch being successful, or her?
Either one.
I don't see Equisearch winning this. My opinion is that most of these are basically filed for the reasons of advancing publicity, the fact that everybody should know that he did all this work and he wants credit for it, and that's fine. I mean, there are a lot of reasons why people file this lawsuit, but I don't believe for one minute that he believes that he's going to collect this money from her, and I can't believe any lawyer would tell him that he would basically win a judgment that he can collect. So why is the lawyer in it? Well, he's getting paid money and can't turn the money down, or he's just accepted his client wants to do it and he could use some publicity anyway, and he's doing it. It's hard to find justification for this stuff, Simon.
Okay, I'm going to play the really stupid person here. How can Texas Equisearch claim that they're out $100,000 when they're a non-profit? And the case was all over the press. It was the most, you know, popular story running. They must have got donations far in excess of 100K.
Well, that was the point I was going to get to, too, is that they have to prove they lost money. So if this case really went anywhere, they would have to open up their books. And I'm not sure they want to open up their books. You know, be careful you get what you wish for. And what if the other side suddenly goes, okay, I'm tired of you. I want to see your books, and I want to know, you know, what money you made or you didn't make, or, you know, et cetera. Well, I think they would be embarrassed. What if their donations doubled? Then how were they damaged, right?
That's really my point.
Yeah, well, I think
you know,
they're well taken.
Yeah, and Texas Equisearch suddenly got on the map. Yeah,
I personally had never heard of them. Had you?
No, prior to that, I had not.
Yeah.
Now, if you look at their history, yes, they do a lot of great stuff, and they are donation-driven, volunteer-driven. I keep coming back to that $100,000 problem.
Yeah. Well, you know, and by the way, I don't want anything I've said to be considered as any type of criticism of them, because they obviously are doing a wonderful thing in our society, but at this moment in time, they're seeking publicity over an issue that basically they probably cannot win. But they are a good agency, and guess what? I now know who they are, and I know they're a good agency, and I learned a lot about them through this, and if that was their goal, they certainly achieved their goal. But if their goal is to collect money from Casey Anthony, I just don't think they're going to achieve that goal.
Well, it's the blood out of a stone thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, that seems to be popular lately in our country, doesn't it?
Right. Okay. Of course, that gives us the ideal segue into Zanny the Nanny.
I love this one. You know, because in all fairness to her, she was abused and misused and all the rest of it, but she's keeping her name in the paper and all these events going under the guise of getting damages. I think that she's entitled to damages against Casey Anthony, certainly more so than our Texas Equus Search, which has no real connection with her. In her case, you know, the whole team basically defamed her. What hasn't been said to me, because I haven't seen a copy of the complaint, it dawned on me, is there someone else named besides her? In other words, did Jose Baez make this accusation? Is he also a party to the lawsuit? I've only seen her name mentioned in the lawsuit. Do you know whether that's correct or not?
I'm not sure, but from what I've gleaned, it was Casey Anthony and her legal team that...
So at some point they may name Baez and all the rest of them, because if they're in any part of that story or they fostered the story, then she has an opportunity to receive sizable damages against them, and they are probably the ones that she can be collect from. Make no mistake about it, Casey Anthony defamed her. I mean, and what she did was terrible. She picked somebody out of the hat to defame, to blame for the murder of her child, which unfortunately got associated with someone else. And let's try it like this. What if she said, Alberto Regenschlaffer Boffer, some name you've ever heard of in your life, killed Kaylee Anthony? What happened if there really was a guy by that name living in Idaho peacefully and his friends are now accusing him of being a murderer because Casey Anthony says he's a murderer, even though she didn't know this person existed and picked the name out of a hat, because she figured was no one could possibly have that name, she still defamed him, and she's liable for the damages of that defamation.
Oh, okay, but here is my problem. The cops ruled Zenaida out very, very early in the investigation. The only real connection is a place called Sawgrass Apartments, which apparently was a place that Zenaida Gonzalez, put in an application for. I mean, what irreparable harm to her character can she possibly claim?
Well, that's a good question. Will people not hire her as a nanny because she's defamed? I don't think it affects her economic losses, but I think it affects a typical loss of reputation and infliction of emotional distress. I mean, if she was truly upset by this accusation and friends said to her, God, are they talking about you? You know, that has damages. So they're not a large amount of money. But same thing could happen to O.J. Simpson. You could get a jury who doesn't like Baez and doesn't like her, the so-called legal team, that thought that Casey was guilty, and they might just whack him with huge punitive damages because they don't like him. And that's what happened with O.J. Simpson, is they believed he was guilty, and that's all that mattered to him, so they gave him every maximum penalty they could think of.
And that's what could happen if Baez is implicated and they're able to go to trial against Baez.
All right. Now, what is the possibility of implicating Baez? He apparently hasn't been mentioned yet.
Well, that's because it's very expensive to litigate with most lawyers. I want to make sure he's right, because if they sue him, they're giving her almost a free defense, because he essentially will have to come into the case and she will have a lawyer, won't she? Because he's there already, and he needs to defend her as well as himself simultaneously.
Oh, no, wrong-o. Baez is on the outs.
Well, he would be if he were named in a lawsuit with her. He couldn't really afford to be on the outs with her, and he would in some way make sure he was safe by staying close to her, because he couldn't afford to be in an argumentative position with someone who's he's suing, because she could easily say, well, yeah, he put me up to it. That would cause some problems, wouldn't it, for him? That would be horrible.
Yeah, but...
Considering she's going to blow off this lawsuit, probably in bankruptcy, what does she care? She's truly mad at him. She could just destroy him.
Could you see Baez being dragged into the story?
Well, what I can see is that the other side is looking for every way to do it. That's the question, is will they be successful? Because are they thinking about doing it? Absolutely. Would I think about doing it? Absolutely. For a great many reasons. One of which is the average person's not crazy about Baez. So, you know, Baez is an unsympathetic person. So basically, any lawyer litigating this kind of stuff who sees him as an unsympathetic person would probably like to add him to the lawsuit, because gee whiz, if you're going to sue people, you really want to sue unsympathetic people. And that's where we are with this. Wouldn't you prefer to sue somebody who was unsympathetic? Yeah,
okay.
As opposed to, say, like, you wouldn't want to sue Mother Teresa, for example, right? So if you got a party that nobody likes.
Probably a bad idea.
Yeah, if you got a party nobody likes, I think it encourages lawyers to sue them. And that's Baez's problem.
Okay. What is Zinaida after? I mean, is this, you know, the 15 minutes of fame, and she can go back to, you know, flipping burgers or whatever the hell it is she does?
Well, I think there's two ways to look at this, okay? Number one is she might not have a position. And the lawyer said, look, I'm going to file this lawsuit so we can make some money out of it. It's a contingency fee. It's not going to cost you anything. And she goes, what the heck? I'm on for the ride. So she may not have any real expectations at all, because she just has no clue what the outcome's going to be. But her lawyers may also be using this as an opportunity to get more publicity. So the motives may be more fashioned among the lawyers than her. You know, I hate to describe her as a pawn, but she could easily be a pawn. So I'm not sure what she really wants. And I have not heard her speak, have you?
Other than a couple of minor utterances, no.
Yeah. But she hasn't exactly jumped up and down and screamed, I've been so wronged and I want all this money and whatever. She basically is just sitting around trying to look at where life's going to take her and whether she's going to make any money out of it. So, yeah, I don't. That's the problem with all of these things, Simon, is you sit there and you try to guess what their motives are when you feel that there's no real financial thing. And, again, some of this might be vindictive, but the only vindictive clients I know are the ones who have enough money and can afford to be vindictive.
Right.
You know, lawyers do not act vindictively for clients without big bucks.
Okay. Let's move on. How about the infamous meter reader Roy Kronk? You know, he's bellied up to the bar, found himself some knucklehead to represent him. And, yep, it's defamation. Casey and the defense team made allegations that he was involved. And
well, that'll teach him to hang five in a public place, right?
Right. You know, and he never retracted them. Kronk does come across as being a little on the unsavory side. Yeah, I'm not sure I'd want to invite him over for dinner.
Are you saying I should worry about my meter reader? I'm going to have to look at him again another time and check him out. Maybe I should be worried about him.
Well, what's your take on the Kronk case?
Well, again, we got a guy who's essentially right. He was not treated well or fairly, and he was an excuse to find an alternative for why this child could have been murdered, and so he was somewhat fodder, in my opinion, on the ongoing defense of Casey Anthony. And do I think this was good? No, I don't. I think that what they did to him was terrible. But at the same time, what's it worth? Again, you know, here's a guy. Did it destroy his reputation? Did he even have one? What's the impact on his life? Is there any impact? I can't see one. What I've read of it, I haven't heard that he was so upset that he spent 4 months in psychological counseling, unless it's done in a beer bar or something somewhere. I don't know. I don't want to accuse him of hanging around bars, but the fact is that when you take a look at this, you keep asking yourself, what is it that happened that you would want to give him damages for? Can you think of anything?
No, I can't. In fact, you know, the more I poke around in the whole thing, it's, Roy, you need to just run away. Yeah, all that's going to happen is he's going to get dragged into, you know, another multimedia blitz, and everyone's going to be interviewing his ex-wife.
Absolutely.
Right.
In fact, that was my next comment is, you know, a lot of times these guys do this and they can't afford the public scrutiny that goes with their life.
Oh, that sounds a bit like Newt Gingrich or whatever his name is.
Newt, you know. Newt can say what he wants, but when it comes time for him, if he wins this nomination in the general election, I don't know if there's a person more disliked in American politics than Newt Gingrich. And it's going to be interesting to see how he, just gets through this. I mean, really, do you know anyone in the politics? In fact, I find it interesting, Republicans who are running against him, like Rick Santorum, every once in a while says, you know, I like him, but he was just terrible to deal with. He was rude. He was oppressive. He was this or that. And you listen to people go on and on about the way he conducted himself as Speaker of the House, and it's not very attractive.
Oh. Don't get me started.
Yeah, I had a dim view of his conduct, too. I would never consider myself a Newt fan. I just thought the way he handled politics during the 90s and into the younger Bush's presidency was just terrible.
Right. And by the way, if you Google Santorum, I didn't know that medical fact.
Oh, I don't know much about. I mean, I've watched Santorum for years, but I don't know much about his personal life, except he has way too many children.
Well, no, but it is fun to Google Santorum. I won't discuss it on the air. It's too scary to even consider.
I'll have to look this up. Now, you now have dozens of listeners
pulling up their Google search. I go, what is it? What is it?
Right.
You've started
well,
the phrase.
And it involves homosexual sex and a substance that is, well, no, I'm just going to move on.
Yeah, it sounds like it's better, but I do know that definitely that's not a popular subject with the Tea Party.
No, no, there's no tea leaves involved in Santorum.
Yeah, it's funny because I was in West Hollywood recently for lunch, and I looked around and I joked with a friend of mine and said, what, no Tea Party signs here? You know, because it's that part of Los Angeles, as you know, is primarily gay. And I can't help but laugh because you can imagine how the gay community feels about the positions of the fundamentalist Christians in our country right now. And they're just really bothered by it. So, you know, they provide a great deal of humor watching how upset they get.
Right. So, going back to our good friend Roy Kronk, can he gain anything from this?
I don't think so. I don't think there's... Oh, who's he going to gain it from unless he's able to allege in some way that her legal team is responsible for this and some way find a way to extend liability to somebody who has some money? Because the bottom line in all this is that nobody has any money. I mean, you have to have pockets to collect from. That's where the expression deep pockets come from. You don't have... deep pockets, you don't collect any money.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. All I see is pointless hours and pointless dollars to get nothing. You know, sure, he can possibly get himself $50,000, $100,000 award. But he'll never see it.
Oh, I agree. You know, and for me, one of the things that always bothers me most about it is that it lights up the public and go, see, this should happen, or that should happen, or should cut some money, or look at this with Zanny the Nanny and whatever. And they're sympathetic because they have a built-in dislike for Casey Anthony. I don't know why, but they do. And so the end result is people want people to win lawsuits that shouldn't be filed and basically, you know, doesn't have any value. So it just creates a problem in our society. There are people out there who are pulling for Zanny the Nanny and all these different people suing her to win and will be angry and disappointed and blame the law when they don't win. And that's terrible.
I'll be honest with you. I don't see any of these people winning. There's too many hurdles in the way.
Well, let's go to the bigger one. Let's call the bigger hurdle. Number one, it's very expensive to try cases. These lawyers can play games because they're busy and they got other income and they can do a lot of different things. But when it comes to trial time, you got to stop everything you're doing and devote your full time and attention to it. Well, look how much time the Casey Anthony trial took up, okay? So, I mean, how do you run a law office and run a practice and feed your family if you're spending all of your time screwing around with Casey Anthony matters? I mean, how do you make a living doing that, Simon? That's what gets me. So at some point, the judge is going to look at the lawyers and go, come on, guys, what are you doing with this case? You're not going to make any money on it. You're not going to do this or that. And why are you occupying my court for all this time? And that's what I expect to see happening. And then some judge is going to start saying, okay, you guys believe in your case, I'll tell you what you're going to do. And then he's going to start heaping work on them, making demands of them. And what he's going to do is try and wear the lawyers out. I bet you've never heard of that before, have you? When a judge doesn't like your case, he can make you miserable. Miserable.
Okay. We've talked about three cases that obviously are not going to go anywhere. You know, the National Enquirer will, Zanny isn't going anywhere. None of them are going anywhere. But there is one case that does have some legs, and that potentially is Richard Grund versus the National Enquirer.
Isn't Richard Grund the guy who looked at Rosemary's Baby too often?
Could be. But he has possibly reasonable grounds. You know, the National Enquirer published a far from flattering expose that he was the person that killed Kaylee in some satanic ritual. And the National Enquirer have money, right? So we have, you know, definitely money on the table, yeah, as opposed to the other lawsuits. You got any thoughts on it?
Oh, yes. The National Enquirer, the newspaper that claims it researches everything and tries to make certain that they get all their bases covered. You know, I've seen them do this before. They did this for Clint Eastwood and paid an absolute fortune to him for one of their bogus articles. And I've seen this with a lot of other people. In fact, one of the most common headlines is in Hollywood is National Enquirer sued again. And I think that they have the greatest exposure. They're going to try and wear them out through that long litigation process. But before we get to that, let's talk about this case. You sit down, you publish a story, and you blame something with somebody. Well, it's okay to go, oh, Richard Grund, you're supposedly a satanic worshiper. What if it were your next-door neighbor? What if it was your cousin? What if they accused your cousin of being a satanic worshiper and doing rituals, and he didn't? How do we know Richard Grund has ever participated in any type of satanic activity? So there's two parts of this case. One is, if the facts prove that he participated in satanic rituals and they blasted him, he's going to get damages for being blamed for her death. But the value of his case goes down because, especially in a fundamentalist type of state, as Northern Florida can be, and a very fundamentalist Christian state, people will look down upon him and they won't want to give him much money for anything. But if it turns out that he's a good Christian boy and he's not done any satanic rituals or a participant in any kind of stuff, then the dollar signs start adding lots of zeros and commas, and this could cost National Enquirer a bunch of money. But the odds are it's going to be settled with a confidentiality clause. I'll pay him a lot of money, and nobody will ever really hear what that money was, because I think that they have libel per se or defamation per se, which means the very act of it being untrue is sufficient to invoke damages as well as punitive damages.
Now, I think it should only be fair to point out that in his youth, he did supposedly follow a cult. And I think that might play a part in this case.
Well, I don't think it will, because, you know, youthful indiscretions don't carry much weight as they get older, or there are a lot of people who wouldn't have been elected to public office. I mean, look at Newt Gingrich. He's trying to get over his somewhat less than useful indiscretions of having sex with people while he makes up his mind about whether he gets a divorce or not. Certainly that must ruffle some feathers somewhere besides mine, and I'm usually not ruffled by that. But I just think it's somewhat two-faced to claim that you're a conservative Tea Party Christian and all that entails with it, while you're basically having a 6-year affair with your clerk in office, and then marry her when you find out your wife isn't well.
Doesn't everyone have an open marriage? I mean,
yeah. Well,
yeah,
I mean, now they're going, wow, if Nuke can do it, why can't I? You know?
Yeah, and Jen and I have an open marriage.
Oh, yeah.
I'm open to leave any time I want.
Yeah. And if you're not careful, Jan's foot might be at your rear, too. You know?
Oh, it would be.
Yeah. I love a good marriage. So, you know, but it's true. I mean, you know, and if there's even the remotest possibility, and believe me, it's not the first time I've heard this story. I had a female client once, and I stupidly asked her why she divorced her husband, why she was getting a divorce. And she looked at me with a straight face and said, my husband wanted me to do a menage a trois with his secretary. And I said, no. And I said, oh, okay. Next. Because I really didn't know what to say to her. And I notice you're not jumping in here because I'm not sure you know what to say to her either. You know, that's one of those questions you kind of shake your head and go, okay, you really asked me that?
So, well, the only comeback I have on that is a dinner party I attended some 30 years ago. It was very nice. Food was great. Hosts were wonderful. And after we'd done eating, you could tell the subject of wife swapping was coming up. And
love them.
And the way I killed it was to say, yeah, I thought about swapping my wife for a really, really good power drill.
Life affords you lots of little choices, doesn't it? You know, I have to tell you that my experiences with that were funny too. I went into a bar on Ventura Boulevard in the old days. We're talking about the late 60s when things were getting a little crazy in our country. And my ex-wife leaned over to me and said, honey, why are they exchanging keys? And I looked over and I looked at her and said, you know, I think it's time for us to go. Well, why do you want to leave? I said, I'll tell you later. You know, we were relatively young and it didn't even occur to her. But it did the next time.
So going back to the more important stuff, where do you see this particular civil case heading?
I think if there's enough of a commitment in the lawyers, in other words, financially, to go the distance, they will win money. I believe that Richard Grund is basically, well, first of all, we know he didn't do the crime, right? So since he didn't do the crime, then basically everything else that's been said has to be untrue, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if everything is basically untrue, then it has to be liable. And the only question then is damages. And so when you go through it step by step by step, it just really, there's no other alternative except for someone to pay. And that somebody would be an actual inquirer. And as I said, I've seen so many instances in my life as a lawyer, particularly living in Los Angeles, where I just see them do one stupid thing after another. And what happens frequently in this town, and I'll say this as a compliment to most actors I know, they end up donating the money to USC School of Journalism to improve the quality of journalism, which I see as a slap in the face of the National Enquirer. But that's what happens. So they're used to being sued. They get sued often. They get sued for lots of money. And they lose frequently, and they pay off frequently. And I think this will be another episode of them having to pay off.
Yeah, I actually view this lawsuit through different glasses. I'm probably guilty of knowing stuff that, you know, isn't out there in the public record yet. You know, so I have to be somewhat careful. But I can see this case getting quite interesting. A question for you. Do you see Casey getting dragged into it?
Well, of course I see Casey being dragged into it. They really didn't name her because it's really a distraction. And they really want to focus it on the National Enquirer. And if she's a party to the lawsuit, then there'll be a tendency to blame her for everything. So it gives the Enquirer an opportunity to focus their blame at a third party. And that way it dilutes the effect of Grund. So if Grund's smart, he'll just proceed directly against the Enquirer and have as little involvement with Casey Anthony as possible, and then just try to weather the storm of expensive defense lawyers who will try to defame him in different ways, like, oh, you did something wrong when you're 21, so therefore you don't deserve damages. Or, yes, you were a satanic cult member, and we did the public a service by exposing you. But those are all dangerous approaches, because if he's been leading a clean life for a long period, not clean, that's not a fair word. If he's been leading the kind of life a jury likes for a number of years, and they think he's redeemed himself, then that could make the situation worse. Because you have to be careful about throwing bad testimony, a character testimony, at a party, because it can backfire. And look at Casey Anthony. Jeff Ashton spent a week talking about what a horrible person she was, trying to convict her for being a horrible person. And in the end, I think he turned the jury off with it. So that's a classic example of taking a risk and having that risk blow up in your face.
Yeah. It is a hairy, scary situation. I've talked to Richard numerous times, and I've even talked to his lawyer, who I believe his name is Doug Roberts.
I should be interviewing you.
And Doug Roberts is a very sharp guy. He's being reviled, shall we say, you know, by the internet quarterbacks as just being a construction lawyer. Well, you know, he's more like a dog with a bone on this case.
You know, Simon, that irritates me when I hear that from other people. There's some things in life are simple. I could take you and the average listener in 2 weeks, make them an expert divorce lawyer. I mean, it's so simple. I got it down to 6 pages of notes for the bar exam. And lawyers that are getting $600-$700 an hour to do divorces, as celebrities particularly, make me fall over and laughing. It's the simplest thing in the world to do. Well, defamation is about 2 pages of law, and it's such a popular subject, you can go to any one of the major books on defamation and find every current case. They're celebrated. If a case came down tomorrow affecting defamation, libel, or slander against any major newspaper, it would be published in every newspaper, be in every treatise, it would be in every book, it would be in every article. So it's one of those areas of law. You can pick up a basic book or what they call a practice book, you know, the how-to books for lawyers, and do it by rote. So the real issue with this guy who's a construction lawyer is how many cases has he tried, how many jury trials, and how good a trial attorney he is. Because if he's a good trial attorney, then the law is simple to learn. He can be a brilliant guy and know the law on defamation, be a lousy trial attorney, and Grund's better off with a construction lawyer who's a good trial lawyer. So I always find these interesting because they never go to the real gravamen of the issue. Can the guy get up every morning, show up in court, wow a jury, sell them, and win a jury trial? Not whether he's a construction lawyer, a divorce lawyer, or anything else. And that may sound unusual to you. But that's the real key. Can he try a case? Not can he read a book?
Well, no, actually, you're feeding right into my thinking. I mean, I've talked to the guy, and he is sharp.
That's bad for them. You know, it's funny. For years, I kept myself off the internet and any bios and other information for two reasons. I represented very famous people. Some of them are billionaires. Some of them were in the top 10 and 20 wealthiest men in the United States. And I used to joke with them. I'd see a lawyer, and they're one's famous lawyers, I'll leave nameless, who can't pass up a TV interview. And I'd see him, and I'd say to him, look at that. How would you feel if I were on TV? And I do it because I love to see the look on their face. They got looks on their face that could melt icebergs, and I'd start laughing. So the best lawyers in this country, the ones who frequently do the best work, are the ones who keep the lowest profiles. Well, since Ash and I wrote the four books and been doing shows for a couple of years, now I got about 4 million hits on the internet, and I can't hide from anyone, so I can't sneak up on anyone. But I used to fight with these big law firms, going, "God, golly gee, I'm all alone," and you know, whatever. But you know, that only lasted for a while till I started winning. But frequently, you get a lawyer who doesn't know who you are because you don't have a big reputation, not all over the news, and you shock them. Plus, when you're in the news a lot and you get a name, and it's really true, defense lawyers with big names, then prosecutors want to notch their belt and put their head on their mantle to show everybody, look, I beat Joe Blow, therefore I'm a great criminal attorney. Well, civil attorneys who do that, the other side tends to get the best lawyers. See, in my case, a lot of times they cite two or three lawyers who are in their early 30s, been around the guy, he's a sole practitioner, you know, don't worry, they'll take care of him until I kick their butt for a while. And then all of a sudden I find myself with a managing partner or a senior partner dealing with a case. And that's what's going to happen with this guy. They're going to take him for granted a little bit. He's going to kick somebody's butt for a while, and they're going to go, whoa, we better put our best lawyer on this case. So they notice, and they catch up quickly. But defaming a lawyer in the press and saying he's just a construction lawyer will make this guy work on Saturdays and Sundays, and he'll be gritting his teeth going, I'm going to F them because they insulted me in the press, and all my friends read it, and guess what? And that guy will work harder on the case and will be much tougher on them if they left him alone.
I'm in total agreement. I happen to have enjoyed my conversations with him.
Yeah.
He's a nice guy.
But he has a sense of anger about their position about the case, doesn't he?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Most definitely. And But think about it. You're a lawyer. If you don't have a sense of anger, you're not going to do your best.
Well, anger is an entire show. A lot of people, including myself, because mommy and daddy didn't pay my way through law school. I did it the hard way, and I finished undergrad with a wife. I started law school with a son. My daughter was born in midterms, and I worked my way, and I paid my tuition because both of my parents had died. And as a result, I'm a much tougher lawyer because of it than mommy and daddy did it. So when you insult me, you know, you're asking for the kind of response that goes with anger. But the subject about anger is I drove myself to finish law school and college because I was angry about life. And I looked at, and every time I thought about quitting, I'd look in the crib and see this young baby and go, I can't quit. And it makes you a tougher human being. But at some point in your life, you can't drive your life by anger. It cannot be the fuel for which your life, you know, runs. So lawyers have to learn at some point to litigate without being driven by anger. And they do. And it's not easy. And it wasn't easy for me to put my anger aside because it drove me to earn a fairly good living and was a backbone of making me successful. At some point, I had to put it down, or else I was going to be a cardiovascular patient, or I was just going to walk out of court one day and fall over and die. So what happens is you get to a point where certain people cause that anger to come back, and it drives you in individual cases. But, oh,
Simon, if you get up and practice law every day out of anger, then, you know, it's like that old expression about revenge. If you're going after revenge, be sure and dig two graves. Well, if you're going to litigate in anger, you're every day you litigate in anger, you're digging a little bit more dirt out of your own grave. And I hope that's the word to the wise for anyone who does live their life and drive themselves every day with anger.
All right. That was a good rant.
Well, the truth can be a rant, and the rant can be a truth. But I'll tell you, when a lawyer's angry, they are hell to mess with. You know, and I had a particularly angry client who was a lawyer and an outstanding one, who I represent in all of his businesses, and he was a famous California trial attorney while he was trying cases, and we've gotten fights once in a while. I'd lean across the corporate executives trying to settle cases, and I'd say to him, look, this is a good settlement, and I know you really don't want to settle it because you want to go after my client, but understand something. When you go home tonight and you put your head in the pillow, the last thing you want to say to yourself is that ABC right now is at his computer working, and he's going to be half the night working on this case to beat you because he's angry and driven by anger. So unless you're ready to get up every night and work as hard and as crazy as my client does, you ought to think about settling with him because he's going to put in 10 times the amount of hours than you do, and he was the top of his law school class. So you think about that. You know, and it really startles people, but it's true.
Do you see any more court cases on the horizon concerning...
No. I'm surprised through these four. There's a one-year statute of limitations on much of this stuff, and so the statute has been running. The only other things that I could see being an issue are restitution issues that aren't resolved, but... No, it is shocking to see the amount of civil cases, including even Michael Jackson's. Here's a family with all this going, and they're suing a guy, deadbeat doctor, who's going to be a valet or, a cyclopedia salesman or car wash guy for the rest of his life because he not only doesn't have a license, but he's shamed by the death of Michael Jackson. So, you know, here you got a guy who's buried in this, up to the brim, and they want to throw another couple of shovels of dirt on it. It's like, what does it mean? Do you think that the other extra shovels of dirt have any social meaning? I don't. Do you?
No. Maybe there's some traction in the National Enquirer suit, but to be honest, it's all pointless. It's boring and pointless.
Well, it won't be to Richard Grund if he earns a lot of money, and Richard Grund has the only one I think that has a real opportunity of winning, and I think he will win it. Personally, I think they'll settle it. They will bluff, and they'll say these things, they'll do everything else, but the National Enquirer actually went to trial against Clint Eastwood, for example, and got killed. Just got killed. And they know every time they've gone to trial over one of these cases, they get killed in these cases. Financially, killed as in, I think the jury awarded $500,000. Well, when you consider how wealthy Clint Eastwood is, how successful he is, and how hard it is probably to really injure his Teflon image, and one he just richly deserves, he's a wonderful human being, then they still gave him $500,000. What would they do for someone who really got dumped on?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm with you, and... But yet I'm against you. Richard Grund doesn't have the fame, shall we say?
Well, I think the lack of fame is why he will win money. That's why they went to trial against Eastwood. Eastwood had fame, fortune, money, and everything else going for him. So they kept saying, "How could you be damaged?" And I know that because I had some involvement in the case. The key witness was my father's best friend, is Clint Eastwood's publicity, our PR agent. And I've known Eastwood off and on since, I was a teenager and he was struggling at MGM headed for Warner Brothers. And their position throughout the entire case was, you're Clint Eastwood. No one's going to give you a dime. And that's why they went to trial, because they couldn't believe a jury was going to give him any damages, even though they knew they were wrong, because it was Clint Eastwood. And guess
okay.
what? They got killed.
We're about 10 seconds from going off
no.
air.
Well, say goodbye to everybody.
Oh, I just got the warning. It is officially 10 seconds. This has been Manny Barling and Simon Barrett, and we wish everyone a wonderful, wonderful week. We'll be back again next weekend. Till then, goodbye.